We're looking at regulation around the hemp industry in Wisconsin and what it feels like to be a grower of a crop that's so new. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. Wisconsin legalized industrial hemp in 2017. Last year's growing season proved difficult. This year, our state has issued more than 1,300 licenses to grow industrial hemp. That's up more than 20% year over year. Are you a hemp grower in Wisconsin? Have you started harvest yet? What's it like to grow the crop? Where do you struggle? We're at 800-642-1234. F.L. Morris is president of the South Central Wisconsin Hemp Cooperative. It's a farmer cooperative growing certified organic hemp for cannabidiol, or better known as CBD. F.L., welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning.
So how are hemp farms currently regulated in Wisconsin? Can you take us through the process?
Sure. Okay. Well, the first step is you have to qualify. So that basically means that you can't have had a federal drug conviction in the last 10 years. So that would be the first step. You can't grow hemp in a city. It has to be a farm or rural location. There's also a series of fees. There's a registration fee and that is a annual fee, and then a licensing that is a one-time fee that totals $500. From there, the state actually takes a look at seed varieties as they come into the state. So the seed varieties have to be approved first then to be less than 0.3% total THC content within the genetics of that variety. And then the second set of regulations would be to do a planting report as to how much of the plant that you have planted that year, and you register acreage, you register the location of the growing sites, you designate a manager, which does not need to be the landowner, but they're responsible for the crop and the legal processes. And then the first step really beyond that is to let DATCAB know with a 30-day harvest notification.
Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection.
Right, who is the agency that's regulating this crop. And it's kind of interesting because they're not really an enforcement agency, but they're basically having to enforce a federal law here. So it really, you know, I feel for them having put themselves into kind of a unique position that they're not maybe accustomed to, you know, regulating in this way against a federal law. So
going back to THC and 0.3%. So last December, the Farm Bill legalized hemp, cannabis that contains less than 0.3% THC. Became legal. So how do farmers get that less than 0.3%?
So that's a big challenge because basically CBD varieties were designed or bred by breeding grain or fiber hemp with the marijuana plant. And that's what reduced the THC but kept those CBD levels high. So they are a function of each other. THC and CBD are a ratio of each other that as the CBD goes up, so does the THC. So the state actually, one of the extension agents up in the Fox Valley area has been tracking data points of test results that come in, and you can take a look at the data points and see that after a certain point, a certain level of CBD, you can't grow it with less than 0.3% THC. So we're basically like limiting farmers' ability to grow high CBD, which would be more efficient. It makes a lot more sense because we have that hard and pretty arbitrary cap at 0.3%. Now, it's important to note that a person cannot feel a psychoactive effect from using THC until it's at like 6, 7, 8 full percentages. And the federal government has set the definition of industrial hemp at 0.3% or less. However, DATCAP's, the Department of Ag's jurisdiction is to work with crops below a full percentage. So there is some flexibility there that the state could be a state and say, hey, even though the federal government has set the limitation at 0.3%, we're going to help farmers out by allowing them to have this grace period because, interestingly enough, you can process out THC completely during the extraction process. So it's like we're putting farmers in a position here where policy does not match with science. The science has not been done yet. And when they grow a crop that has a higher than 0.3% THC content, they're forced to destroy it, even though that THC can be removed through processing and destroyed and, you know, the farmer can still market the crop.
And we're going to get to destroying the crop and the whole testing process here in just a moment. We're talking with F.L. Morris. She's president of South Central Wisconsin Hemp Cooperative. That's a farmer cooperative growing certified organic hemp for CBD. You can join in. Are you someone who wants to start growing hemp? What's held you back from getting started? How can the state better monitor industrialized hemp? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So you talk with the hemp growers in your cooperative. What challenges are they facing with how the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection is testing these crops?
Okay, so that's a really important and kind of complex issue to understand. So back to the 30-day harvest notification. We, farmers in our co-op, we have 9 producer members, first year of our co-op. We gave the 30-day harvest notification, and DACCAP's target was to come 1 to 2 weeks before our harvest date. So that would be 2 to 3 weeks after we gave the 30-day harvest notification. For 3 producers of our set of 9, that target was hit, and their THC results were 0.0%. So when DACCAP follows its target, we're kind of in the clear. For the rest of us, our sampling didn't happen until the day of our harvest, which makes no sense at all, because as they receive the backlog of testing coming in, it's important to understand that this plant takes cues from the sun too. So like everyone in the state is kind of at the same place at the same time. But because it's a photosensitive plant, so it becomes mature based on cues from the sun. When the sunlight goes down, it starts to flower and mature. So the state has got a huge influx of sampling. It has to do a huge backlog. To my understanding, they had about a dozen people bouncing all around the state having to bring the samples back to Madison. Even if they were taking samples all the way up in Ashland Bayfield, they had to drive it, you know, what is that, 8 hours or something, all the way back to Madison's DACCAP facility to have those tests run. So those of us that were sampled closer to our harvest date, because the THC level goes up along with the CBD level, there is a peak point that would be that harvest date that you want to hit. It's actually quite narrow, where at that point, the CBD starts going down and the THC continues to rise. So the sampling time is completely crucial. If DACCAP is late, it will cause a hot crop test.
And when you say a hot crop test, above that 0.3%.
Right. And at that point, had DACCAP come out when during their target time period, there is one possibility to get a retest. Now, these tests are $250 each, and that's per field, per variety. So I grew 5 varieties. That was $1,250 of testing fees. Now, you can get these same tests done by a private laboratory and get more than just the THC content, which is all that DACCAP was giving, was a tenth of a percentage. We didn't even get to know what the hundredth or thousandth of a percentage was, which would be relevant because if we're finding out that we're 0.399999 versus 0.400001, that could be the difference of just one day of transition in that plant. And, you know, of course, DACCAP wants to cover their butt as much as they can. So sampling dates are really crucial. And DACCAP can't really play the, you know, we're just learning, because folks over there are learning, making a living wage with benefits, getting paid for every hour of their work. But farmers over here, we're learning too. And when the State Department of Ag messes up, we're out.
We're talking with F.L. Morris. She is heads up the South Central Wisconsin Hemp Cooperative. What questions do you have about growing hemp? We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment. More conversation here on the Ideas Network. The hemp crop is still in the development stage in Wisconsin. Markets are still getting established. We're looking at how growers are doing with industrial hemp here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Last year was the first year hemp could be legally grown again in Wisconsin, and the state has issued more than 600 processor licenses this year. Hemp growers, where is your farm? What's it like growing this crop? What struggles have you faced this year? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. F.L. Morris stays with us, and F.L. is a hemp farmer and leads the South Central Wisconsin Hemp Cooperative. So the director of the Plant Industry Bureau for the State Ag Department spoke with WPR recently. Brian Kuhn says Wisconsin really aims to test hemp 2 weeks before a grower's expected harvest date, but the state, as you said, wasn't able to get to all the growers within that time frame that they were hoping.
There were definitely some in that crunch time where we weren't there 2 weeks in advance of their harvest date. And certainly, you know, there probably are a handful that we may have gotten there beyond their planned harvest.
And so Brian also went on to say that sometimes growers didn't show up for testing or that farmers changed their dates as well. So is that an issue in terms of communication?
Well, yes, because let's consider the lack of research around this crop. Farmers are flying blind. You can't even really look up CBD on the internet and find anything. What, you know, people really needed to do was look up cannabis cultivation, meaning marijuana, because there's more data and information out on that at this point than there is on growing CBD. However, the cultivation of the plant is the same regardless. You would grow it in the same way. So, you know, I just want to speak to that comment that Brian made about a handful of people that may have slipped through the cracks. That could mean hundreds of thousands of dollars of investment, not to mention the profit loss by DACCAP being a little late. So, you know, the other things that was mishandled was getting those test results back to those farmers immediately, because the state, like I started to mention earlier, opened up the option to have an additional test to try to get a different result, which by flushing the plant with irrigation with water, you can potentially bring down that THC level. So if you pay another $250 per test, you could get a retest. Well, that only would be effective and try and help you out to salvage your crop if DACCAP had their ducks in a row, because we would have gotten sampled. We should have found out in a couple days, like you can with a private test, which is a fraction of the expense. I mean, a private test that gives you a lot more information of a full cannabinoid profile is around $50 to $65. DACCAP's charging $250, and again, they only gave us one-tenth of the THC percentage.
Well, let's take a call now. Jeremy is joining us from Racine. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks, Jamal. I got actually two questions. One, if your crops come back hot and it's above the 0.3%, are you able to still salvage some somewhat of a harvest for the hemp and sell for paper production and things like that? And the second, would it be more feasible to convert the grow operations into an indoor facility where you can better manage the cycles of the grow to properly, like, maybe put a better hard calendar date for testing to keep it from going too hot?
Jeremy, great questions. FL?
So to answer your question about can the crop be salvaged if it is a hot crop test result, the answer is no. You have 10 days to file the destruction report. The only thing you can do is try to have a retest. But after a certain point in the season, there's just no hope because the THC continues to rise over time. And then the second question.
How do you destroy it?
Oh, the destruction. Well, either you harvest it, which is quite time consuming, and depending on your acreage is also a huge expense. You harvest it and you burn it in a pile. You send photos of that to the Department of Ag, or you can attempt to mow it, chop it, plow it in. But this stuff is like, as you know, the trunk is like a sapling. I mean, this stuff cannot just be mowed with a regular brush hog or a haybine. It's very tough. It's very fibrous. So, you know, just the idea of destroying a crop at all, I mean, destroy your crop. That's like asking a doctor to kill their patient. You know, we shouldn't have to destroy a crop after we've spent 6 months growing it. We grew the CBD. The state really needs to look outside of the box here and be bold and allow us to process the THC out of the crop. And if they want to be involved in that every step of the way and have a chain of custody with the processor, let's test these products before they reach the consumer, not in the farmer's field.
Well, speaking of consumer, and Jeremy, we're going to get to your second question in a moment. It's in my head. But what are the markets like for you? I mean, we see lots of processors. Is there a market if you do have a successful crop?
So that's a really interesting situation right now. Basically, not unlike the dairy industry, the people that have the power and that are making the money are the processors and the distributors. The farmers are getting pennies on the dollar already, even though we're not grandfathered in to 50 years of poor ag policy and malicious companies. We still are already getting set up to make very little compared to the value of an acre. So, for example, farmers are taking in as little as $10 to $15 per pound for their biomass crop, which refers to like the bulk of the plant as opposed to just the tops of the plant that have a higher value. They're taking in, they might be making $10,000 to $15,000 at $5,000 to $15,000 on the crop. Well, that looks really good if you've been growing corn and beans in the state. That's still very profitable. However, when you translate that out to those one-ounce bottles you're seeing all up and down all the CBD stores on Willie Street, that turns into $2.1 million. And the farmer's making $15,000, and that looks good. The exploitation is already here. And it's really important for us as farmers to get together and to work with people who are concerned with partnering. They care about our ag economy. They care about us as people. They care about the hard work that we put into. Those are the folks that should own the processing and retailing. And, you know, just want to talk the cooperative talk here, because what if cooperative businesses owned or got together, put farmers together, put processors together, and put retailers together, as well as distributors, and then all of the workers were unionized? Then that $2 million could provide wages for hundreds of people instead of two families.
We're talking with F.L. Morris, president of the South Central Wisconsin Hemp Cooperative. It's a farm cooperative growing organic hemp for CBD. Jeremy also was asking, can you control the growing conditions? Could this be grown indoors?
So, yes, it can be. And a lot of the flower, I'm going to call it the bud that you're seeing, the CBD bud on at retail outlets that is quite pristine looking, is grown indoors. However, facing climate change and carbon emissions and a dying planet, you know, I don't know that bringing everything to indoor high energy output is really the right choice. I think outdoor grown is something where we need to have some more flexibility about our breeding, so we can have some hot crops that are then processed out and really breed for Wisconsin's climate. So yes, you can grow indoors, and many people do or will, but it's important to understand that the cause of a hot crop is essentially out of a farmer's control. It's the following things. It's the genetics of the plant. That's important. But again, the state approves the genetics on the way in. It seems like that should be enough, but it's not. We get tested. I mean, we have them in our hand, in our production system all throughout. But it's also like inclement weather, stressful situations. THC in a plant rises when the plant is experiencing stress. It actually protects the plant. So what would make more sense is if we actually bred THC and CBD side by side, like they're doing in other states, and regulate it as a ratio. So when you nail a really high CBD, that should open up how much THC you can have in your plant. Because then we don't have these pests and disease issues that are basically controlled by a higher THC volume in the plant.
I want to ask a policy question here before we run out of time. The State Senate passed a bill this month that would change how hemp is regulated in Wisconsin, and this would bring the state in compliance with last year's farm bill. What could this change bring?
With the new hemp 2.0 policy?
Yeah.
You know, there's a couple things in there in terms of law enforcement, and you know, what I didn't see in the policy was some more farmer forward pieces to it. So, for example, I really want to see us be able to process the THC out of the crop. In terms of what else is in that policy, I still have to take a closer look at it.
Do you see hemp being a crop that will become more established in Wisconsin? There's a lot of risk right now. I mean, farmers are trying to figure this out. The state's trying to figure this out. You know, last year was the first crop, basically. So where do you see the risk?
So I think as long
how
as...
How do you manage that?
Yeah, I mean, you get together and you form cooperatives, because what we've been able to do is share a ton of information, make sure that no one's slipping through the cracks, do our best to grow a crop and have that crop pass a test. We've also been engaged in group buys that open up our access to seeds. The seeds for this crop, CBD crop, were between $1 and $2 each. seed. So, of course, seed companies want to make their money now because they realize that us farmers are going to start breeding our own, saving our own seeds, which I'd very much like for us not to do. But in terms of the risks going forward, everything is up in the air. I think what actually we might find out is maybe this crop does need to be grown on a small scale, because trying to chop the biomass like we would an alfalfa or a corn silage crop, it might not be possible considering the wet conditions that we have in the fall and the very narrow harvest window, that if you wait like we do with corn, your CBD is going to go down. It won't even be worth harvesting. So we might find that this is actually a small scale crop that you get out there with loppers and you cut them down as trees.
FL, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
FL Morris is president of South Central Wisconsin Hemp Cooperative. Coming up, we learn about a new virus plaguing our bald eagle population. Stay with us. News is next here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the health of our bald eagle population here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Bald eagles are facing a new threat, and researchers have found nearly a third are infected with a newly identified virus. And scientists say this virus may have a role in Wisconsin River Eagle Syndrome, which was first described more than two decades ago. But a clear link hasn't been fully established. So what questions do you have about this syndrome and the new virus? Have you ever spotted a bald eagle that looks injured or sick? What did you do? We're at 800-642-1234. Tony Goldberg is an epidemiology professor at UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. He's also associate director for research at the university's Global Health Institute. Tony, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Well, take us back to the 1990s when scientists first found Wisconsin River Eagle Syndrome. How does that play into what you just first now discovered about this new virus?
Yeah, well, about two decades ago, scientists noted that eagles were dying, in Wisconsin mainly, of what we can call a mystery disease. They were found sort of staggering around, vomiting, not getting their bearings, and inevitably they'd be taken into a clinic or a wildlife rehabilitator and they would die or have to be euthanized. So for many years, scientists here at UW-Madison at the National Wildlife Health Center, which is also in Madison, were trying very hard to find the cause, but never did. So this was an example of a disease that sort of went on the shelf. We didn't really know what was causing it. We kept the case records and samples, and it just sat there for a while. So about 4 years ago, my colleagues at the Wildlife Health Center and I decided to try some new fancy techniques to get at this syndrome, specifically virus hunting. So we thought...
You went virus hunting.
Virus hunting. We went virus hunting. That's right. Which is a lot of fun, actually. It's discovering things about the microbial world that you didn't know existed. But it's made possible by new technologies in DNA sequencing. So there was a suspicion this might have something to do with the virus. We took archived tissues from the National Wildlife Health Center and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and we subjected them to this broad-spectrum virus hunting protocol that my lab and several others do. And we discovered a surprising new virus, and we called it bald eagle herpesvirus. That indicates the genus of viruses that it's in. There's a lot of interesting things about it, but one of the things that struck us right away is that this is actually a relative of the human hepatitis C virus, which was suggestive because hepatitis C, as its name suggests, causes hepatitis in humans, liver damage, mm-hmm. and we were seeing liver damage in these eagles. So that was telling. We also found that eagles living in Wisconsin were much more likely to have this virus than eagles living elsewhere, and that eagles living in Wisconsin near the Wisconsin River were even more likely to have this virus. So things were sort of mounting up. We were starting to really get excited. We were popping the champagne corks thinking, wow, we've solved Wisconsin River Eagle Syndrome. And then, as scientists tend to do, we looked more carefully and made things more complicated.
And you have to retrace your steps and try again. And when did it get more complicated? What did you find?
Well, you know, it's It would be nice, and I deal with a lot of wildlife disease issues. It would be very nice if every sick animal had a virus or a bacterium and every healthy animal did not.
create such order in our universe.
I know. Wouldn't it be what a wonderful world it would be. But that doesn't happen. So what we found is that there were plenty of eagles that had this virus that were not in Wisconsin and had not died, apparently, of this virus or this mystery disease syndrome. We found eagles infected as far away as the states of Florida and Washington and all states in between. And about a third of the eagles in the United States that we tested, it was about 40 to 50 eagles, had this virus. So that started to worry us because it's not unusual for there to be normal viruses circulating in wildlife. So did we find the cause of Wisconsin River Eagle Syndrome, or did we find just some normal old eagle virus that we didn't know existed? So that's kind of where we are right now. We see these tantalizing associations. You know, eagles in Wisconsin more likely to have it. Eagles, the virus bears some resemblance to other viruses that cause similar disease in people. But it's not a clear-cut story. So we're left with several possibilities. You know, maybe this virus causes the syndrome, but not in all cases. Maybe the virus has nothing at all to do with the syndrome. Or maybe it interacts with other factors to cause the syndrome under specific circumstances.
I think you've covered all your bases of possibilities.
Yeah, typical scientist answer, right? It could be anything.
Talking with Tony Goldberg, who is a professor of epidemiology at UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. He's telling us about a previously unknown virus affecting nearly a third of our country's bald eagle population. You can join in. Have you ever spotted a bald eagle that looked injured or sick? What did you do? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. When you look at these eagles who are infected by this newly discovered virus, what are the symptoms or what are you seeing in these eagles?
Yeah, good question. Well, remember, there's two things we're talking about here, the virus and the disease. Eagles that have this disease, Wisconsin River Eagle Syndrome, are really, really sick. They are staggering. They're vomiting. They have seizures sometimes, although it doesn't look like they're starving. They're typically in good body condition, which means whatever is affecting them is hitting them pretty hard and pretty fast. So that's what we see with the syndrome. With the virus, we're not sure. So we see eagles with this syndrome that have the virus, and we see eagles that have died of other causes also with the virus. But one thing that's interesting is that all the eagles that we've been able to examine, of course, are dead because otherwise they'd be flying around and we couldn't examine them. So why did they suffer the fates that they did? So some of the – what people may not realize is that eagles living near humans in North America are pretty persecuted. They lead hard lives. They may get electrocuted on electric wires. They may get poisoned inadvertently or on purpose. People sometimes shoot them. Or they may scavenge on the side of a road and get hit by a car. So we had samples of those types of eagles to analyze. And we started to wonder, well, are those really normal eagles? Or could they have been weakened by something that then made them have to perch on an electric wire or not be able to fly away from somebody with a shotgun or scavenge roadkill and put themselves at risk?
So, like finding the perfect subject of eagle is very difficult for you.
Well, yeah, it's not common to sort of get samples from perfectly healthy, wonderful eagles that we see flying beautifully around in the sky. You know, the ones that come into agencies like the DNR and the National Wildlife Health Center are dead for a reason.
They've been compromised by something or someone.
That's a possibility, yes. So we're wondering, could that be the case here? Could there be diseases or infections like this new virus we found that could weaken eagles? We really don't know. So that's the next step, is to look more broadly at healthy eagles that are not coming in because they've had accidents or other things that have killed them.
How common is it for you to be able to study a healthy eagle?
It's not that common, as you can imagine. It's not something you can walk out your back door and sort of grab onto. But there are people who do it. So we are, of course, as a country very interested in the bald eagle as an animal, as the symbol of our nation. So there are groups around North America who have studies of bald eagles that are healthy for other purposes. Maybe they're studying behavior or diet or toxins, things like that. So we're hoping to collaborate with groups like that to add infectious disease to the list of things that they're studying.
Bald eagles were removed from the endangered species list, as you know, in 2007. Could this new virus have a negative impact on population numbers at all?
Another good question. We have no evidence right now that this virus causes any risk to the population of bald eagles in America. We're not saying it doesn't, of course, because we're scientists and we never say anything 100% one way or the other. But we know that eagle populations are rebounding. Wisconsin is a great place to be an eagle. If I were an eagle, I would probably want to live in Wisconsin because we have lots of great habitat and the Wisconsin River is ice-free in the wintertime, so there's lots of fish to catch. So all in all, I think our eagle population is healthy and rebounding, and it's a real victory for conservation and for the Endangered Species Act and other legislation that help protect eagles. But we also shouldn't be complacent. We don't understand all of the health and conservation threats to bald eagles, which is surprising considering how central they are to our culture, but we don't, so we can't discount it. I think this is, in a sense, we owe Rachel Carson another note of thanks because she sort of alerted us to the critical dangers of pesticides, namely DDT. And once we protected eagles from that, we now have the luxury of understanding what else causes them to suffer disease and mortality.
Oh, it was like a gateway to understanding the other things that can really damage eagles and the population.
Absolutely. Yeah. So and partially because of that, early investigations into Wisconsin River eagle syndrome focused really hard on toxins. You know, we're so finely attuned to thinking about toxins when we think about raptors and disease that we kind of were tunnel visioned a little bit. So this is nice because I think it opens up the realm of other possibilities.
We're talking with UW-Madison epidemiologist Tony Goldberg, who was one of the scientists who found a new virus in eagles that we're talking about. Are you a fan of watching bald eagles? When was the last time you saw one? What questions do you have about their health and well-being in Wisconsin? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation on bald eagles in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the health of bald eagles and a new virus that's impacting their population. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The bald eagle was removed from the endangered species list about a dozen years ago. There are now about 1,700 nesting pairs in our state. And scientists have found a virus in bald eagles that's related to human hepatitis C virus called BEHV. Do you remember the last time you saw a bald eagle? Where did you see it? What questions do you have about viruses affecting raptors? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tony Goldberg is an epidemiology professor at UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, and he stays with us. Let's go to the phones now. Gary is joining us from Chippewa Falls. Hi, Gary. What's your question?
Well, good morning. My brief question was, in regards to the virus of the eagles, are you finding it in juvenile eagles? Or are you finding it predominantly in more mature eagles?
Good question, yeah.
Yeah, great question, Gary. Thanks for asking. The answer is we're finding it in all ages of eagles. We looked to see if there might be a propensity for very young or very old eagles to be infected with this virus, but there isn't. It just seems to be equal across ages. And this syndrome that we're studying, bald eagle or Wisconsin Eagle River syndrome, That also doesn't seem to affect young or old eagles. It seems to hit all ages, including adult eagles in their prime. So it's a great idea, because sometimes you do see diseases affecting the young and the old, but that doesn't seem to be the case in this virus or this syndrome.
Do we know how the virus spreads?
We don't, and that's a great question too. So the virus, not a lot is known about these viruses. In humans, hepatitis C is, of course, sexually transmitted or transmitted by intravenous drug use. I've rarely seen bald eagles using intravenous drugs, so I don't think we can do that. We can talk about that. But there's a lot of possibilities. They could be transmitting it directly from one eagle to another. They could be getting it from something else. So these types of viruses are known to infect lots of different wildlife, including mammals. So maybe it's something they're eating. That's another one of these questions that we really are interested in getting at.
So we're in the early stages of figuring out BEHV. You're collaborating with a lot of partners on this. What is the next step?
Yeah, so good question. The next step, well, there's a couple of next steps. We definitely want to figure out how this virus is being transmitted. We want to figure out if it's an eagle virus or if they're getting it from something else. We want to figure out if it's as common in perfectly healthy, happy eagles as in these eagles we're studying that are coming in because they've died. But most importantly, we want to know, is this virus really causing disease? It's not uncommon to find viruses in nature that are simply normal parts of the natural ecosystem. And if this is one of them, it's a very interesting virus, but it may not pose a threat at all to eagles. So that's kind of the big question we have to go at. But it's hard because, you know, there's not a lot of eagles that are going to come and volunteer for some sort of study or anything like that. We have to be creative and make inferences indirectly.
Let's take another call. Diane in Erin County. Hi, Diane. Oh, Diane's not there, but was wondering, have you heard how many eagles' nests failed this year?
Yeah, another good question. I haven't. That would be a great question for my colleagues at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. There is an eagle nest failure rate every year, and eagles are tracked to measure that, but I don't actually know what this year's statistics are.
Well, broadening out to other raptors, are bald eagles hit harder by viruses, do you know, or by diseases?
Another great question. Bald eagles are, I would say, are not hit harder than other raptors by diseases. They do have a list of diseases that affect them. And there is one virus that has taken quite a toll on raptors, and that's West Nile virus. West Nile virus, as we know, entered the United States in 1999 and spread throughout the U.S. and affects birds. But raptors are one of the birds that are really susceptible. So when the virus first came into the USA, we saw a lot of dead hawks and eagles. And there was even a case in Utah a few years ago that was investigated by the National Wildlife Health Center here in Madison of bald eagles that died of West Nile virus, not from getting bitten by mosquitoes, but by eating other birds that had West Nile virus. So they're very susceptible. In fact, West Nile virus was the number one infection on our differential diagnosis list when we started looking at the syndrome, but the birds were all negative.
Talking with Tony Goldberg, he's an epidemiology professor at UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, and we're learning about a new virus affecting bald eagles. Let's go to Lindsay now in DeSoto. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi, good morning. Tony, we'd like to invite you to DeSoto Area School District. We're right along the Mississippi River, and you can see eagles daily, either out fishing in the river, along with all the boats that we have fishermen fishing in the river. There's the eagles flying around, and we also see them, you know, flying over the countryside and alongside roads eating the roadkill you mentioned. So come on up to our school district, talk to our kids.
Open invitation.
There you go.
My question really focuses on the food source, because listening to what you've been saying, there seems to be some kind of connection, because in my mind, if they're eating either the fish or the roadkill or other mammals that they're able to kill and eat, they're also feeding that to their young, and that may be a reason why we're seeing this virus attack all age groups. So I'm wondering if we see this particular virus, have you seen it in any fish? Have you seen it in other mammals as well?
Thanks, Lindsay. That's a great question. And I've been to DeSoto. It's a great area. I would love to come back and watch your bald eagles. So let's talk about that. But I have not actually found this virus in any other animals because we haven't looked yet. But that is a distinct possibility. We suspect it could be in other birds, for example, maybe in fish, maybe in mammals. Eagles, as you know, if you've watched them, have a lot of interesting interactions with other species. In fact, there's a famous story that Benjamin Franklin did not want the bald eagle to be the national bird of the United States because he called them a bird of bad moral character. That's right. He wanted the turkey. But eagles were a bird of bad moral character because they do this thing that eagle biologists call piracy, where they will wait until another bird catches a fish or gets a prey item, and they'll swoop in and steal it. So they don't make an honest living, according to Benjamin Franklin. But that same behavior also puts them in contact with other birds, other prey items, and sometimes they fight. So you're absolutely right. Where this virus lives in nature is an open question.
The food chain certainly is something to look at, and where it enters the food chain.
Absolutely.
Let's go to James now in Wabasha, Minnesota. Good morning, James.
Yes, good morning. How are you all today?
Good.
Here in Wabasha, they have the National Eagle Center, and they have a great program for both youth and adults. And you can be within a few feet of the bald eagles. They're eagles that were injured and can no longer fly, so they're called eagle ambassadors. And it's just a great place to visit. They have tours, school tours, and there's lots of information, and anybody who wants to learn about the eagles should go visit there.
Well, James, thanks so much for bringing that. And as you said earlier, there is so much good work being done to protect eagles.
Absolutely. You know, I feel a little bit guilty publishing these results because now I can't look up in the sky and see an eagle without thinking of all the viruses flying by. And I'm afraid other people will too, but we can't lose sight of the fact that these are magnificent, wonderful birds and the symbol of our nation and important to Native Americans millennia before North America was colonized by Europeans. So it's really important to appreciate eagles in their full sense, you know, for what they are, and to understand that yes, we have to know the threats they face, but we also have to appreciate what they are and work to conserve them.
Well, Tony, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Tony Goldberg is an epidemiology professor at UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, and we've been talking about a previously unknown virus affecting nearly a third of our country's bald eagle population. This conversation comes to you on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.